You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you might think this stretch of cold weather means it's safe to go out on the ice in most of our lakes and rivers, but it's not always that simple. We'll go over some winter safety tips with a DNR warden. First, the Red Cross announced last week that it would no longer send fire response teams to houses in some parts of Milwaukee. 10 Milwaukee zip codes cutting through the central city would stop receiving on-site services, according to the new Red Cross policy. Instead, they would have meetup places at places like police stations. The decision raised concerns for some city officials, and in a press conference earlier this afternoon, Mayor Tom Barrett and the Red Cross announced it would no longer enforce that new policy. 7th District Alderman Khalif Rainey has spoken out against the policy, which he believed could disproportionately affect people of color. He joins us now. Alderman Rainey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this issue.
So the Red Cross changed course, but what was your initial reaction when you heard this new policy rolled out last week?
Well, it was quite disheartening to hear that the Red Cross decided to change its delivery model and would no longer provide, you know, the service that's desperately needed when individuals are experiencing what could possibly be the worst experience of their life. So considering that I have several zip codes that will be impacted, the 53206, 53216, 53209, 53210, and 53218, you know, I felt compelled to speak out, you know, on this particular issue. It was really speaking to classic redlining.
Yeah, talk more about that. In a statement, you said this is a slap in the face and it would disproportionately affect people of color. Can you talk about that?
Well, those zip codes I just mentioned are, you know, predominantly African-American zip codes. And the others that were in the city of Milwaukee were on the south side where we have a large Hispanic population. But more importantly than simply, a racial discrimination, it was really speaking to a class issue where individuals who may be middle class or living in poverty, the Red Cross decided that they no longer were going to provide necessary services to these people and family. So that was very disturbing, and you know, I felt it was necessary to speak out against it.
Some of your fellow people on the city council had said it looked like the Red Cross was calling inner city Milwaukee unsafe, and Red Cross Regional Chief Executive Officer Patty Flowers had told reporters that safety had been part of the decision. Here's a listen.
I'm always looking at safety for everyone involved, so that's always a factor. But again, this is where the majority of our fires are, in the Milwaukee County area, and so that's why we're targeting those areas right now.
So that's where most of the fires were. The Red Cross was going to tell fire victims to meet them at police stations or the Red Cross headquarters instead so they could be at a safe and warm place. Was that potentially a good compromise?
I mean, considering that, you know, there's a strife in the relationship between African-Americans in our local police department, you know, not even here, just simply the city of Milwaukee, but in this country, you know, I think that that's problematic, you know, considering the transportation issues that may be involved as well, you know, for a family to be wrapped up in a blanket, stand on the bus stop if they have bus fare to get to the police department. I think that that's extremely problematic. And furthermore, there is no documentation that speaks to any harm being done to any Red Cross volunteers. So that was never produced. I never saw anything that, you know, highlighted that there were safety issues for those who volunteered for the Red Cross.
Talking to Milwaukee Alderman Khalif Rainey about the Red Cross policy in Milwaukee. They had last week announced that they would no longer be dispatching volunteers to the scenes of fires and other incidents, but rather having victims meet up with Red Cross volunteers at selected designated locations. That just earlier this afternoon was reversed. Alderman Rainey, another concern that the Red Cross had raised was, hey, we're having a hard time getting enough volunteers. This is just a more efficient way for us to use them. We might be going to this model in other communities in the Milwaukee area. Already in rural areas, they don't have the resources to get people on the scene. So it's a matter maybe of just not having enough volunteers.
Well, I think that if the issue is a lack of volunteers, I think the original call by the Red Cross should have been to request additional volunteers to reach out to the community, specifically within these zip codes, and actually provide some training for those who are interested and make them prepared to respond to these crises. Just saying that we're going to discontinue the service, I think that that was, you know, again, a slap in the face to the people who live in these neighborhoods, and I think it was a poor decision by the Red Cross. I'm I'm thankful that they decided to change their course.
So now that the course has been changed, Alderman Rainey, do you see an opportunity maybe for a coordinated effort between an alderperson like yourself, people in the community, and the Red Cross to try to solve these problems together?
Indeed. I think it's an opportunity now for the Red Cross to host some public listening sessions. You know, I would have wished they did that initially, because now, you know, we may have individuals who no longer want to support the Red Cross. But I do see a gap, a void that's needed to be filled. Maybe it's an opportunity for some additional people to get out there and be involved and provide this type of service if the Red Cross feels they're too far stretched.
And do you see maybe, now that this is happening, people in your community, whether it's through the Red Cross or otherwise, getting interested in volunteering to do this kind of work?
Well, I think that, you know, this particular concern has highlighted a need, you know, whether it's for volunteers of the Red Cross or just indeed for the members of our community to step up and take on this and respond to these type of situations, not only these type of situations, but many other situations that are occurring in our community. I hope that it calls for, you know, our neighbors to get out there and get more active. You know, I wish, again, the Red Cross would have initially made that call. You know, I would certainly have stood side by side with them and said, hey, let's get more volunteers to come out and do these services. But I think now the conversation is on the table, and hopefully it's not the end of it, but just the beginning.
We'll leave it there. Alderman Rainey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate you. Take care.
You too. That's Khalif Rainey, alderman for Milwaukee's 7th District. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The ice trade was big business in 19th century Wisconsin. It was an industry that depended on the cold weather you might be cursing right now. Historian John Gerda tells us about this important industry.
It was a crop that required no seeds. No one had to turn over a single furrow of earth or pull a solitary weed. Year after year, it was simply there, available to anyone with the right equipment, and it began to grow again the minute the harvest was done. This miraculous crop was ice. If you're tired of winter, try to remember that cold weather once supported a vital Wisconsin industry. Without ice, thousands of households and some major industries would have been seriously inconvenienced. The ice kings of southern Wisconsin were John Kottmeyer and his descendants. Their annual harvest climbed from 4,000 tons in 1878 to 400,000 in 1900. Much of it was cut in their hometown on the Milwaukee River, but the Kottmeyers developed a network of more than 100 ice houses on lakes many miles inland. The harvest followed the same steps in every case. As soon as the ice was thick enough, a foot was good, 18 inches even better, horses with spiked shoes were harnessed to single-bladed ice plows with outriggers attached. Each blade cut a deep groove in the ice, and the outrigger neatly scribed the line of the next cut. When the entire field had been plowed, horses and men repeated the process at right angles to their first path, creating a checkerboard of ice blocks that could be sawed or chiseled loose with relative ease. Workers with long-handled pike poles pushed the ice down open channels to horse-powered conveyors, which lifted the blocks into ice houses on the water's edge. The ice houses were double-walled buildings insulated, like the ice blocks themselves, with thick layers of sawdust, a material of prodigal abundance in 19th century Wisconsin. With enough sawdust packed around it, ice could last for more than a year in storage. For most consumers, ice was a luxury at first, something the wealthy used to cool their food, make ice cream, or add just the right chill to their mint juleps. For two major Milwaukee industries, brewing and meatpacking, it was a necessity. Because lager beer had to ferment and age at cool temperatures, it was a seasonal activity at first. Most Wisconsin brewers made beer in winter and sold it in summer, using ice houses or artificial caves to keep their kegs cool. Ice was just as important for local meatpackers. Pork and beef had always been cured in salt, but the advent of ice shifted the emphasis to fresh meat. In 1879, Patrick Cudahy built an ice house in Milwaukee's Menominee Valley and instantly had a year-round enterprise. Before long, every major packer was slaughtering, packing, and shipping meat with the assistance of ice. Business was good well into the 20th century, but machines eventually killed the ice trade. The Pabst Brewery installed its first artificial refrigeration unit in 1880, and by 1889, the company had stopped harvesting natural ice altogether. Residential customers made the same switch, buying machine-made ice at first, and then replacing their ice boxes with refrigerators. More than a fourth of the Milwaukee area's homes had refrigerators in 1936. By 1950, the proportion neared 100%. The ice fields are idle today. Frozen lakes and frozen rivers attract snowmobilers and fisherfolk, but no one comes with thoughts of harvest. Not even memories remain of an industry and a way of life that simply melted away.
John Gerda is an award-winning historian and author. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, ice is still a big part of life here in Wisconsin, especially when we head out to enjoy the winter sports. But just because it's cold out, even really cold out, doesn't mean that the ice is safe to go out on. Todd Schaller is Chief Conservation Warden with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He has 30 years of natural resource protection and outdoor recreational safety experience in Wisconsin. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Todd, I think a lot of people might just look at the temperatures the last few days and think, okay, the ice is safe now. Is that a safe assumption to make?
It isn't, and I think we go by, and the message we've continued to try to push to people is that, you know, we really should never consider ice safe. And then I realize we enjoy fishing and snowmobiling and ice skating and all the things out on our waterways, but in the back of your mind, you need to keep in mind the fact that it's varied on water body to water body. It can be varied even on the same water body, and you just need to realize that it's not solid ground, and it can break away, and we don't know when. So
what's the best way to say or to figure out if a particular lake, say, is probably okay, if this is something we can even consider going out on?
Probably the best source of that information is, you know, local bait shops, local sports clubs. There's even some websites, you know, fishing websites that are out there that, you know, probably have the best handle on local ice conditions. And that's kind of where we direct people. As a Department of Natural Resources, we don't monitor ice conditions. We don't report on ice conditions. We let that to the locals who are the most knowledgeable.
I think some people might listen and say, okay, this is pretty obvious stuff, but I grew up in a town in Michigan where it was an annual tradition where you'd watch for the first truck to go through the ice on the lake. We do actually see problems with vehicles and people falling through the ice, right?
Every year. We see it early, we see it middle of the winter, and we see it late. And you're right. We really try to emphasize that, and it seems like common sense, but it really isn't, and people just need to take safety cautions.
And I think about the people maybe going out to try something like ice fishing or snowmobiling on the ice for the first time ever. What kind of stuff do you recommend for them if they're not those seasoned pros?
Sure. Probably the first thing is know before you go. You know, get some idea from locals. Maybe go with somebody who's familiar with that water body. So you know you're going in an area that should have good ice conditions. Some safety things to consider would be to, you know, make sure you carry a cell phone. Probably put it in a plastic bag, so if something were to happen and you were to get wet, it'll still function. There's what they're called ice picks. They're manufactured, or you can go online and find ways to hand make them or make them yourself. But It's a mechanism that if you were to fall through, it allows you to kind of pull yourself out of the water, because now the ice is slippery and you won't have a good grip. And the last thing is, if you were to go through, that when you come back onto the ice, to not immediately stand up, spread out your body weight, roll, crawl, but don't stand up, and always go back from where you were coming from, not away from where you were coming from, because you know where you came from held you or was good ice at that point in time.
We're talking to Todd Schaller. He's Chief Conservation Warden at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We're talking about ice safety in Wisconsin. And by the way, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you do things out on the ice in the winter? Do you go ice fishing? Do you snowmobile on an ice-covered lake? Do you cross-country ski or snowshoe out on the ice? We'd love to hear your story. It doesn't have to be safety-related, though I hope you are being safe about it. Call in if you do any of those winter activities out on the ice. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Todd, I want to break down some of those safety tips a little more. I've walked on lakes on the ice in the winter, of course, over the years. I wasn't familiar with some of these things, these ice claws or picks. Where would we find these? What are they like?
They're basically, if you make them yourself, it's kind of a nail inside of a wooden doll or handle. Manufactured ones, you know, they have safety mechanisms so that the pick or the nail isn't always exposed. But it's almost like a screwdriver. If you were to have to pull yourself out, you dig them into the ice and basically crawl or claw your way out of the ice. It's just a way to, get out of very slippery conditions. And the other thing is to not try to lift yourself, but actually try to swim and come out horizontal versus vertical.
Right. So the one thing you don't want to have happen is you get yourself out of the ice, stand up on the edge of where it's been breaking anyway, and then fall through a second time.
Yep, exactly.
And then can you talk about what to do? You've fallen through the ice. You've brought your picks. You've gotten out. Talk about the health risks and when to seek medical attention.
Sure. I mean, hypothermia, once you're wet, moisture, takes your body temperature down immediately. You add wind to cold temperatures, and that just accelerates that impact or effect. So hypothermia can hit within minutes, and there's varying levels of hypothermia. So the first thing you should do is try to get to some place warm. So is that a vehicle? Is that a residence along the lakefront? And do that as quick as possible. Once you're in that setting, get out of the wet clothes, get into a dry blanket or a dry clothes, and slowly warm your body temperature up. So some of the first impacts of hypothermia are you start to lose dexterity in your hands and fingers, your joints, your outer extremities. And then as you get colder or that length of time increases, that impact obviously then can be more severe and it could eventually cause death. So
let's bring on a caller now. We've got Rick on the line in Alma. Rick, hi.
Hello.
Do you have a story for us, I understand, Rick?
I've got a couple of stories about breaking through the ice myself and watching other people break through the ice. I'll tell you the most dramatic one where I almost died. I had some property up in northern Minnesota, and I was walking along a creek that ran through the property, and like an idiot, I walked over to a depravity in the snow, stepped on it, bam, right down into the water up to my waist. And it was at the time 40 below zero, and I was a mile from the cabin. So what I did was I crawled out of the water up onto the snow, made my way out to the road that was about 100 yards through the snow. By the time I got to the road, my legs were like stovepipes.
Wow.
So I hobbled back to the cabin, and thank God I had a good fire going. I got out of those wet clothes, got next to the stove, and that was my lesson. Don't walk towards a low spot in the snow.
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing that. Glad you're still with us to tell the story. And Todd, that brings up a point. I imagine we got to be more careful on running water, a creek or a river, than on standing water.
Yeah, a lot. Great point. And Rick's story was true. And the running water, flowing water, whether creeks and rivers are obviously the obvious one, but even keep in mind that our lakes have inlets and outlets. So that can generate an area of thinner or less ice that provides less safe ice. So those are things to consider. Think about springs are another area that tend to hold water open or create less ice. So lots of factors that, as I said earlier, can, on a single body of water, you can have varying levels of ice thickness based on flow, inlets, outlets, springs, all those factors.
Rick, thanks for that call. I'll go next to Dan on the line in Duluth. Dan, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm relatively new to the area. I've only lived in Duluth about 4 years, 3 years actually. And I don't know the process by which one measures the ice. So how do you actually measure the thickness of the ice without, to determine whether or not it's safe or not?
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Todd, can we do that?
Sure. It's a good question. And I kind of refer people, particularly if they're new to an area or new to a water body, to kind of talk to the locals, talk to a local bait shop, and they're going to give you the best sense of what the ice conditions are. How does one person measure ice? A lot of the folks who are experienced, and what they'll do is they'll walk out a short distance, either with a spud buyer or an auger, you know, test the ice, maybe drill a hole or chop through, and then realize it's, you know, what the thickness is. And if it's thick enough, they'll continue a little further out, do the same thing, and then until they get a good sense of what the ice conditions are on that particular water body. But again, go 100 yards, 200 yards, a half a mile, and the conditions could be completely different.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Todd Schaller, Chief Conservation Warden with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He joined us to talk about staying safe on the ice this winter. And you can get some more safety tips over at the DNR website, where you can just search for ice safety. Now it's been 10 years since the Great Recession started and a long recovery process along the way. By some measures, the workforce has recovered at a national level, but it's a more complicated story than the unemployment numbers might tell us. According to the Pew Research Center, the workforce is older, it's more diverse, and a lower percentage of the population is working. Some areas have seen economic booms, some still haven't really recovered at all. And for people who don't have a job, it's gotten harder to get back into the job market. Steve Deller is with us now. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Well, what do you see as, Happy New Year to you too, as we hit 2018, what do you see as the biggest long-term impacts of the Great Recession?
I think that the biggest impact right now is going to be the kind of the widening of the labor demand between those that have skills and education and those that really don't require skills and education. And I think that there's going to be a continued widening gap there.
Right. And I want to talk about that a little, looking at middle class workers, in particular, middle skill workers. That Pew report I just mentioned a few moments ago, a little more information from that, found those kind of jobs had been disappearing to some extent before the Great Recession. The Great Recession accelerated that. So we're seeing more and more polarization, jobs at the top end, jobs at the lower end, not so much in the middle. So, Steve, what do you see there?
I think you're right. I think it's the we've been following a widening income gap. And a lot of times we talk about that as the rich getting richer, the 1%. But I think that what's really driving a lot of this is that hollowing out of the middle class, is that a lot of the job growth is either at the higher end or at the lower end. And those jobs that are in the middle are becoming more difficult to find. And the I think there's a lot of frustration, because it's becoming really obvious after the end of the Great Recession that a lot of those kind of traditional middle class jobs are kind of slowly going away.
And I want to talk about some of the fallout from what was happening during the Great Recession. A lot of people maybe at a lower middle income level, maybe all their money was tied up in their house, which they lost to foreclosure. Maybe they lost a couple years off the job market with the skill development that would be bringing them, the savings they weren't getting. Even if the recession is completely over and they're back to the job they had or something like it beforehand, that's a lost couple few years there for that.
It is. And you have to realize that a lot of folks, particularly some of the baby boomers, found that their retirement funds were basically wiped out. And that, and if you wipe out your retirement fund and you find out that your house is underwater, your mortgage is bigger than what the house is. I mean, that's a real kind of emotional kick. So even if now 10 years later, you've been able to crawl your way back, that's almost a lost decade of really kind of being kicked while you're down.
How does this break down regionally? I mentioned we have some areas where, man, the economy's booming. Things are doing great. It's hard to find a place to live because costs are going up so much. That's not the story, obviously, everywhere.
No, that's true. I mean, you look at Wisconsin, and there are certain pockets within Wisconsin that are doing very well. Madison and the Madison area is doing well. The Appleton, Fond du Lac kind of area is doing okay. Eau Claire is doing okay. But there are other parts of the state that are just not doing very much at all.
And this was something that was happening to some extent before the big recession, right? What did the recession do to maybe accelerate that?
I think it brought it more home in terms of what the engine of economic growth in the state of Wisconsin is, and nationally. It's not just Wisconsin, but it's nationally. I think that we've kind of been so dependent on manufacturing in this state as kind of that engine that, you know, it got hit really hard in the Great Recession, and it still hasn't come back completely. I mean, you do have pockets in the manufacturing sector that are doing okay, but a lot of the growth has not been related to what we call goods producing. It's not in manufacturing. It's not in agriculture. It's in computer software, information sciences, information services, things like that. That's where a lot of the job growth is going. But Wisconsin, outside of places like Madison, there isn't a whole lot of that kind of activity going on.
Let's stay with manufacturing for a minute, because that's politically what gets talked about the most. At the state level, at the national level, can we bring manufacturing jobs back? But some manufacturing jobs got automated, especially, as I understand it, during the recession. Even if the manufacturing industry is doing well, does that mean manufacturing jobs are going to be out there?
The types of jobs are changing. I think the net number of jobs in manufacturing is going to stay relatively stable. And I think that that's because you're seeing two things that are going on. One is you're seeing a lot of lower skilled routine type manufacturing jobs being replaced with automation. And I think that's a lot of the middle class jobs that are kind of disappearing. You know, I could barely get through high school and get a job at a manufacturing plant making good, decent middle income wages. Those kind of jobs are disappearing. So within manufacturing, you're seeing the shift towards higher skilled. Rather than having a lot of medium skilled to low skilled workers on the assembly line, you're seeing those replaced with automation. And now you need some type of engineering degree, an associate's degree, maybe a bachelor's degree, to basically keep that equipment running.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison, looking at the long-term impacts of the Great Recession about 10 years after it started. And one thing in that Pew report we mentioned earlier, Steve, there's a bigger penalty for not having a job. Being unemployed more and more seems like it's making it harder to get back into the job market. What's happening there?
Part of that is the marketability. If I'm going into the job market, and I'm competing with, say, four other people, and four other people have been actively in the job market, and I have been, there's a big gaping hole on my resume, it's going to stand out like a sore thumb. So if I'm an employer and I'm looking at people that have had continuous employment streams and those that have been out of the labor market for a while, guess who I'm going to go with? So it's kind of a catch-22. If you can't find a job and you leave the labor market and you do some type of, say, self-employment as a stopgap, when you go back into the labor market, it looks like you haven't been doing anything for a few years, and that looks bad on your resume.
And there's been talk also about what the economists call labor force participation. That means how many people of job-having age are actually out there in a job or actually seeking a job. Sounds like that's lower. There are more people who potentially could be working, but who aren't.
Well, that's partially the aging of the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. It's partially the demographics of a lower pool of people that are, say, leaving high school age and maybe doing a couple of years of college and then entering the labor market. That pool of workers getting smaller. That's one of the reasons the two-year campuses for the UW got shifted around. So you're seeing that kind of demographic occurring. But at the higher end, at the retirement, we're finding a phenomenon of folks that are deciding that they want to retire. They retire. They're retired for a couple of years, and they decide they want to go back to work. Those types of workers are really kind of throwing a curve into how we understand what's happening with the labor market.
Yeah, how do we account for that?
Why they're entering back in,
or the impact that has then on the market or on the job market downstream?
Because some of them, it's happening in a couple of different ways. One way is that they're entering kind of low skilled jobs is because they want a job. Mm-hmm. Think of the Walmart greeter. That's, you know, it's not pressure. It gets them out. It gets them interacting with people. And then you also have a lot that are starting their own businesses. We're seeing a lot of kind of retirement entrepreneurship that's occurring. And again, what you're seeing is this bifurcation. You have retirees that are going back into the labor market because they want to work, and they're working maybe $10 an hour. That's fine. But how that's playing out in the long-term dynamics of the labor market is really kind of up in the air.
I want to get into rural Wisconsin a little bit. We see numbers, different numbers, showing that there are a lot of communities where jobs declined, haven't come back. Think of the towns with the paper mill that isn't there anymore. Are there prospects for economic comebacks for places like that?
I think it's going to hinge on commuting. I think that a lot of these rural communities that have very high quality of life is to realize that, you know, they're becoming bedroom communities now. We're seeing commuting distances expand tremendously. People are willing to commute great distances to work. So I think that if a lot of these communities, these smaller rural communities, kind of say, you know what, this is a great place to raise a family. This is a great place to live. And by the way, there's this hub called Eau Claire or Appleton, what have you, that's within 50 miles. That's a reasonable commuting distance. And I think that's what a lot of these rural communities are going to be kind of moving towards.
I know some people in those communities, that's not the identity they want. They want a self-sufficient community with the local jobs, not just service jobs catering to the commuters who leave town.
That's exactly right. And that is a transition that I think a lot of communities are going to have a hard time coming to a realization, is that local employment is going to be service-based, local entrepreneurships, kind of servicing local residents, other local businesses. But the, you know, a major employer growing and expanding in a lot of these smaller communities is becoming much more difficult to do, particularly with manufacturing, because they're moving more and more and more towards automation.
We're talking to Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. We're looking at the long-term impact of the Great Recession in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. How did the big recession affect you? Are you still feeling it? Do you feel like you have had a recovery personally, regardless of what the nation as a whole is doing? Or are you still trying to catch up? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick this conversation up in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our discussion now about the Great Recession. It's been 10 years since it started in December 2007. The workforce now doesn't look like it used to. The economy as a whole has recovered, but there are a lot of asterisks, a lot of exceptions there. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. What does 10 years out look like for you? Are you seeing some lasting financial effects? Was your job impacted? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers. Tony is with us in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What was your story, Tony?
Actually, I got laid off in 2009. I was working for a manufacturing company for windows and doors. And when I got laid off, I was making just about $10 an hour. And I decided to go back to school and ended up getting an associate's degree in mechanical design. And now I work for as a parts catalog author for John Deere. And so I make well over double what I made before the recession.
Tony, thanks a lot. Congratulations. I'm glad that that worked out for you after a rough start with that layoff. Thanks for that call. So, Steve, what do you think?
That's a success story, mm-hmm. and I wish that we could point to more success stories like that. I think that a lot of times, I think folks that have the initiative, like Tony did, to say, you know, I need to improve myself. I need to go out there and be a little bit more proactive. I think those workers are going to be doing fairly okay in this recovery. They're doing okay. The ones that are more in a reactive mode, if you will, are going to have a more difficult time. I was talking with a person from Milwaukee County who is trying to get information on what's what we're calling a gap in soft skills, mm-hmm. soft job skills, and these are folks that they have a hard time showing up on time and whatnot, and that gap there is going to be getting worse over time.
There's going to be some differences, I imagine, if I'm laid off at 25 and I'm going to train for a new career. Okay, if I'm laid off at 55 and I'm going to train for a new career, and then their employers are going to look at me and say, do I want somebody who's just starting at that age, whether that's legal or not for them to think that. It happens, we know.
It is. It's not legal to do that. Mm-hmm. But again, you're right. You're perfectly right. If I'm an employer and I'm looking at two people, one is 55 and has been out of the labor market for a couple of years, and another that's 25 and has said, well, I took some time off to go back to school, guess who I'm going to hire? Is that fair? No, but that's the way business operates.
Tony, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Moira in Fontana. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for the show.
Good. What do you think?
I think you hit it with your statement about the lost decade. I'm a 54-year-old woman. And I used to have a phenomenal career, and work dried up with the recession. And I have that 10 years gone where the earning, the savings, the retirement, the house, it's all gone towards survival. And, the question, what do we do? I'll tell you what, your articulation of that problem is a godsend to even hear. I know there are a lot of us out there. I know there are a lot of us that have been wiped out. And I'm just wondering, is anybody measuring this? Is anybody getting ready for this wave?
Moira, thanks for that call. So a wave of people, she's in her mid-50s. They're going to be trying to retire, but a decade of no way to save for retirement, Steve.
It's essentially we used to talk about the Japanese lost decade. I think historically we're going to look back at this time period and say that this, for a large part of America, was a lost decade. They were, a lot of folks were financially wiped out with the Great Recession, and they're just trying to rebuild, and they're trying to rebuild on jobs that pay less.
Thanks for that call, Moira. I want to share a couple comments from the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda says she sold a house at 10% loss. Interest and 401k earnings have never replaced what was lost. And Shelley says disposable income now is less. Expenses are more. Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi. I had mentioned to the screener that I worked, I'm 71 years old, I worked 40 years as a tool and die maker, worked at A.O. Smith Corporation, Tower Automotive. And, when we worked back then, layoffs were a part of life. And maybe you'd get laid off 2 or 3 months out of a year, but you'd always get called back. Well, after this big recession, one thing that doesn't get mentioned is all the places where people used to work, they tore those factories down. Delphi, A.O. Smith Corporation, Briggs & Stratton. You go all over the city where there used to be factories, there's either empty lots or there's shopping centers. So the likelihood of people being called back and those jobs actually starting up again when the factories were torn down, the likelihood is pretty slim.
Michael, thanks for that call. Yeah, you have hope when you're laid off and the factory's still standing. You don't have hope of getting that job back when the factory's gone.
No, they're not. And the manufacturing jobs that are coming back on smaller scale, flexible manufacturing. The U.S. really can't compete with China and Southeast Asia when we're producing large scale commodity, what we call commodity goods. But where Wisconsin manufacturing and U.S. manufacturing is that smaller scale custom type manufacturing. And those are not those big plants. Those are their smaller plants. And sometimes you don't even know it's a manufacturing facility that's in that particular industrial park. I think the other thing is that this in manufacturing is this kind of idea that you're going to get laid off every now and then. I think that the wages in manufacturing allow folks the flexibility of taking that time off. Indeed, a lot of workers in manufacturing will say, well, okay, well, they're shutting down for 3 months, and I've got enough savings set aside, and, oh, by the way, I'm a member of the union, and the union can help me out here, is that I can ride that through, and that's not really possible much anymore.
Michael, thanks for that call. We're talking to Steve Deller, economist at UW-Madison, looking at the long-term impact of the Great Recession on the country, on Wisconsin, and on you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Steve, reading some of the reporting on this, something I hadn't thought of as much, the Great Recession, the early couple years in particular, affecting people's credit ratings, especially if they were in one of those underwater mortgages they had to leave behind, lost a job. Well, now, credit ratings 10 years later, can you get a house? Employers are looking at credit ratings sometimes for potential employees. This is another bit of lasting damage.
You know, I hadn't thought of that, but I think you're exactly right. I mean, if you've basically had your house foreclosed on because it was underwater and it made perfect financial sense, you're in essence declaring bankruptcy. And you know what that does to your credit rating. You don't have a credit rating for at least 7 years. And again, you're getting employers that are looking at things like your credit rating. And if you have a poor credit rating, an employer is going to say, well, that's a signal that you may not be responsible, and that's going to put you down on the list of being hired. That may not be fair, but again, that's how firms look at this.
Another outcome of the Great Recession, again, in the Pew Research study, more inequality. It was already on the way up, but more so because of that. Why?
It's getting much stronger. We've been tracing the widening income gap for the last 30, 40 years, depending on which set of data you use. It kind of started in the late 1970s, early 1980s, at this widening income gap. And it's occurring on two ends. One is the super rich, the one percenters, the 0.1 percenters, the super rich. They're getting really, really rich. That's pulling it off. But the other thing is that middle class type job is starting to hollow out. Before the Great Recession, you may have been an accountant making $50,000 an hour, which was a fair job, and you lost that. And now the best you can find is an assistant manager at a fast food restaurant making $25,000 a year. It's those types of jobs that are getting squeezed out, and it's making that widening income gap worse.
Steve, briefly, the stock market's looking great. Now, are there lessons for the next recession in a nutshell?
If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be here. I'd be driving a brand new Ferrari on Wall Street. I'm waiting for the bubble to pop. But I think what's happening is that corporations have so much cash on their hands that they're keeping the stock market or the stock prices inflated. There's really no place else for investors to go right now. As Linda mentioned, interest rates are so low. Where are you going to put your savings? In a CD that pays 0.5%, or are you going to put it into a mutual fund in the stock market? So there's a lot of things that are keeping it elevated, but I'm surprised it hasn't adjusted itself.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, talking about the lasting impacts of the Great Recession.